The Plain Talking Podcast with Geffen Russell Jones.
Hello and welcome to this new episode of Plain Talking. In this edition, we'll hear about the disturbing situation facing Christians in Mali, a country in West Africa. We'll also find out about an ancient pilgrimage route in South Wales, before Brother David Jardine closes with a meditation. But first, I recently caught up with Pastor Charles from Mali.
I am Charles Nyabaga Jara. I am a pastor missionary in Mali. Yes.
Well, thank you, Charles, and welcome to the podcast. I wonder if you could tell us about the troubling situation facing Christians in Mali.
Thank you, Geffen. I think there is lately an increase of military operations from the Malian army and its allies on radical jihadist groups such as Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam al-Muslimin, called Jnim, and the Islamic State. And because of that, there is, as the result, I can say, we can see continued clashes, harassments of civilians, kidnapping of notabilities in many villages, forced payment of zakats, assassinations, blockades of communities, intimidations, of course, closing of schools for children, and no farming, actually. There is a loss of livelihood and a massive exodus of people from the center of the country to the south. Really, what happens, 3 weeks ago, a group of jihadists conveyed a group of pastors in the Mopti region for a discussion. Of course, they were inquiring about how they pay tithe. And during the meeting, they explained to the pastor that the land they live on right now belong to them, to the jihadists, because they have conquered it. And they put a fourth proposition in front of the pastors. They said, first, you have to provide men who will help us fight against the army. If you can do that, second, you have to provide money. So you have to give money so we can hire fighters or mercenaries. If you can do that, so surely you have to pay the zakat. And if you don't agree to pay the zakat, you have to leave the place, the land, and go live somewhere else. And they gave him an ultimatum of 1 week to go think about this and then come and give him an answer. They were supposed to give the answers like 2 weeks ago now, but nothing happened. We don't know what's going on. Maybe this is the rest before the storm. We don't really know what's going on. Because of that, of course, the churches, the Christian communities are frightened, feel helpless, and we don't really know what to do, where these people will go, because that's their homeland, that's their native land, and they are asking them, those Christians, to leave the country. That's what's happening right now.
Well, it sounds frightening.
Yes, it is. Yes.
What's the impact on pastors and on Christian churches, do you think?
I think it's a very big problem. As I said, it's really frightening when you feel helpless. You see, this is the rainy season in Mali, and most of these pastors in these rural areas are farmers. They can farm. So there is a starvation that is predictable. They need to be really protected. And there is nothing they can do. They can't really fight. And what happened in some villages, people started to pay the zakat because they don't know where to go. So they have to pay this tithe to the jihadists. In other people, they are still thinking what we should do. That this is a very worrying situation.
And what do you fear will happen, Charles, if if the pastors go back and say, no, we're not going to cooperate with you, what happens next, do you think?
I think if you don't cooperate, you have to leave. Because they said they conquered the land, so it belongs to them. You pay the zakat, you give men, or you have to leave the place, your village, your hometown. That's what's going to happen. So this is what is really worrying us in this situation.
And what would that mean, Charles? That would mean you'd have to leave Mali to go to a neighboring country?
No, not to exactly leave Mali. Maybe some will go to neighboring country because it's that area shares borders with Burkina Faso. So they go to Burkina Faso, or now they have to move to the south of the country, which I think they can maybe peacefully before something happens. And well, that's the only option they have, to go south or go to a neighboring country.
And Charles, without giving your own details away, but how are you and your family coping with this pressure?
This is very hard for us. I mean, I'm in the south of the country. I have experienced the kind of situations because I live here myself in the capital city as an internally displaced people. I was a victim of this kind. I know what it is for this Christian communities, how they feel today. I mean, I woke up this morning safe and sound, and I know that's not the case for many Christians today in the center of this country. I don't know how they slept. I mean, I'm sure they slept with fear in their heart, in their minds. Someone will come tomorrow and expel you from your house. This is really very, very frightening feeling I have myself, because I had experienced these kinds of situations.
And you mentioned, Charles, that the people doing this have a jihadist kind of agenda. I wonder if you could explain to us what that means, what these groups are, and what's kind of motivating them.
Yeah, I think these are two main groups operating in the center of the country. That's Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam al-Muslimin, called Jenin, and the Islamic State. We call it AE or IE, Islamic State. Yes, okay. They just want to apply the Sharia law in this part of the country. That's their agenda, to promote Islam and the Sharia law. I think we have experienced these kinds of situation in 2013 to 2014, the north of Mali, when they applied Sharia law. These are the same people who are operating today in the center of the country. It's the same agenda, to promote Islam and Sharia laws.
And do you think behind it all, the part of it is to eradicate the church or churches in Mali, so to establish one religion?
Yes, I understand. I think part is to eradicate any contrary belief, not only the church, but even those practicing traditional religion. They just want to eradicate any contrary belief and establish their own religion and agenda in this part of the country.
Well, Charles, for those of us who are listening to this podcast, many people will want to pray. How can we pray? What kinds of things would be helpful?
I think prayer is very, very helpful. When we heard this news, where we have the Association of Evangelical Protestant Churches of Mali, who call for fasting and prayer. That's, I think, what we can do. And maybe this is the last gasp of the dying beast, I hope. Because, you see, in this kind of situation, as Christians, we need to call upon God again. We have experienced this type of situations. 1 year ago, they had the same ultimatum. And when the day they came to the village trying to expel the Christians, two of their cars collided. And most of them, at least 15 to 20 jihadists, died that day. We don't know what happened. So we are praying for a miracle. And we think we need the help of the prayers, the support of our Christians, our brothers worldwide, to pray for the church in Mali and mostly for these Christians in the center of the country.
Pilgrimage seems to be capturing the public imagination once again, appealing to people of all faiths and none. Here in South Wales, a medieval pilgrim's way has opened up from Llandaff Cathedral in Cardiff to Penrhys in the Rhondda Valley. I asked the Reverend Dyfrig Lloyd, priest of a Welsh-speaking church in Cardiff, to speak about its significance. I spoke to Dyfrig during the recent Royal National Eisteddfod held in Pontypridd, not far from Penrhys.
I'm Dyfrig Lloyd, and I'm the vicar of Eglwysdewi Sant in Cardiff.
And we're sitting in the Church of St. Catherine's here in Pontypridd, having the Eisteddfod, bustling, you can hear chatter and a bit of music occasionally, raining outside. But you've just given a lecture on the history of Penrhys, the plinth of pilgrim, only a few miles away from and it was fascinating. Thank you, Dyfrig. I wondered very briefly, could you give us a little a potted history on Penrhys as a place of pilgrimage?
What we know of Penrhys is that it became a popular place of pilgrimage in the 14th and 15th century, and it is a place shrouded in a lot of traditions and myths. But one of its stories is that someone was walking and they saw an image of the Virgin Mary in an oak tree. Mm. And from that encounter, Penrhys slowly became a place of pilgrimage where a church was established. A large wooden statue of the Virgin Mary was placed in the church, and where pilgrims would come bringing their prayers, their hopes, their fears, and their offerings, and laying them at the foot of Mary.
And it sounds like it was regarded as a place of healing for ordinary peoples.
It is, yes. Not far from where the church stood is a very small building nestled on the side of a hill where the Well of Mary can be found. And pilgrims would go, according to some of the poets of the time, described how people would go to Penrhys on their knees. They would go to the Mass and receive communion, and then to the well to take up the water, or to wash in the water, hoping for healing.
Mm. And it was, I guess, and he brought this out, part of Henry VIII's his dissolution of the monasteries and everything else, Penrhys disappeared.
It officially disappeared, I think we can safely say. Thomas Cromwell ordered that the statue of Mary be taken from Penrhys, taken to London and burnt. Mm. And that's what happened. But as his officials went to take the statue, there was a lot of people gathered around, and they had to quieten the crowd before they get on with the job of removing the statue. And so officially, as a place of pilgrimage, it ceased to be like many of the places. Mm. But there is plenty of evidence to suggest that people still went there with their prayers, with their hopes, and hoping for healing, to take up of the water in the well up until the very end of the 19th century. And we also have evidence that the vicar of the local parish church would go up and take water from the well to conduct services of baptism in the parish church.
Yeah, which brings us really to the present day Dyfrig. So the statue, it's there now, and I think was erected in 1953.
Yeah.
By the Archbishop of Cardiff, Catholic Archbishop. It's part of the Cistercian Way, which covers all of Wales.
Yeah.
Probably all of the UK.
Yes.
And on Penrhys itself, there's a very modern housing estate, and in the middle of which there's a judge. So tell us a little bit about what, in your opinion anyway, what the significance of this shrine is and this Christian presence that remains on Penrhys.
The church in Penrhys is known as Llanbair, and it is a ecumenical church. 8 different denominations support the work there. And it is a church that is very much set upon responding to the needs of that particular community in any and every which way they can. And I think anyone going on pilgrimage to Penrith, having been to see the well, having been to the statue, really should also try and make a visit to the church and see how a renewed relationship with God then translates into the practical actions of sharing Christ's love with other people and taking that back with them to their context and communities.
And finally, Brother David Jardine talks about a remarkable missionary and man of prayer.
Of all the missionaries who served during the history of the Christian Church, Hudson Taylor must surely be one of the greatest. Born in Barnsley in Yorkshire in 1832, he died at the age of 73 in 1905. Most of his adult life was spent in China. He worked first for the China Evangelization Society, but gradually grew frustrated with them, as they did not have the freedom to make policy decisions on the ground in China. Everything had to be referred to London, which in those days took months and months. So Taylor in 1865 founded the China Inland Mission. People found him a tremendous inspiration, and by the year 1900, he had 750 missionaries in the field. What made the China Inland Mission different was the fact that they depended on God for everything. This applied particularly in the raising of funds. Taylor would not allow appeals for money, and when he was back home in England, would not allow churches to hold special collections. There was one occasion when he was speaking in a church about the mission in China. One of the church wardens, a retired army colonel, was so inspired that he wanted to hold a retiring collection. Taylor would not allow it. That would be taking it out of God's hands. Taylor was staying with the retired colonel, and when they went home, he told Taylor that he felt he was wrong in not allowing a special collection. Next morning, when they came down for breakfast, the colonel immediately admitted that he was the one who had got it wrong. He said that if they had had a collection the previous night, he was going to donate £5, a considerable sum in the 1860s. But now, he said, on reflection, I'm going to give you £50. Taylor said that God's work, done in God's way, will never lack God's supply, and it never did. In the early 1870s, Taylor had a bad fall in which he was paralyzed. The condition was so bad that he had to go back to England to recuperate. For a long time, he was bedridden, but those who came to visit him always noticed that down at the bottom of the bed was a great map of China, over which Taylor was constantly praying. Indeed, I believe that the amazing spiritual revival taking place in China today is partly due to Hudson Taylor's continuous prayer for the country in the second half of the 19th century. Doctors thought that Taylor would never get back to China and might not even walk again, but through the prayer of faith, he did recover and was able to return. And people noticed a change. He seemed very calm, didn't worry about any of the work of the mission. The reason was that he had learned how to hand everything over to God and leave it entirely to him. There was one occasion when Taylor received a letter to tell him about serious riots in areas where mission stations were situated. Immediately he began to whistle a little refrain, "O Jesus, I am resting, resting in the joy of all that thou art." That was the way in which he lived his life, that blessed life of resting and rejoicing in the Lord under all circumstances, while he dealt with the difficulties, inward and outward, great and small. That way of life is possible for all of us, giving ourselves completely to the Lord, yes, but also giving him specific areas of our lives, events coming up, and people we are involved with. Our job then is simply to trust that the Lord has taken them and is looking after them. When I give things to the Lord in this way, I find that they always go far better. And also, I can be at peace about them.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this edition of Plain Talking. If you have, please subscribe to it wherever you found it and leave a review. Plain Talking is sponsored by The Plain Truth, a magazine of understanding. For more information, please visit plain-truth.org.uk. That's it for now. And so, until the next podcast drops, God bless you all from all of us at Plain Talking.